Hey, welcome to the Bible Savvy Podcast, a weekly conversation on how to understand, enjoy, and apply God's Word. I'm your host, Nikki Lucas, and I'm joined by Executive Pastor Eric Ferris and Teaching Pastor Clayton Keenan. We're about to jump into another passage from the Bible Savvy Reading Plan, but before we do, guys, I gotta know. It's another food question. Here we go. If you could only eat a food that rhymed with your name, what would your diet consist of?
It's gonna rhyme with your name.
Foods that only rhyme with your name.
It is a kind of weak rhyme, but Clayton and bacon are close.
Yeah.
There's not a lot that rhymes with Clayton, but if you went with Clay, which most people do not call me, although now and then, I think we had a guest who calling me Clay, but I had some people when I was younger who did. So you could, I could have a filet, which opens up all sorts of possibilities. That could be filet mignon.
Dang.
It could be fish filet. I could have a parfait or sorbet. I could actually go to a buffet. I could drink Chardonnay or a latte, maybe a latte. I don't know if the accent is wrong, but I think that opens up more if it's Clay.
Clay.
But that's, most people don't call me that. Mm.
Does your wife call you Clay?
No, her sister does.
No way. Yeah,
really?
Clay.
Yeah. So yeah, her sister Jen, we call her Aunt Jen. That's what my kids call her, and their kids call me Uncle Clay. And yeah.
Interesting. Weird. Eric?
I think I'm going to starve. There's no, I can't think of any food that rhymes with Eric.
What about Ferris?
I couldn't think of anything. Ferris, I got nothing.
So you're starving?
And my middle name is Jason.
So you could get the things that kind of end with an N.
Jason, ramen. I guess I'm eating ramen for the rest of my life. I feel like we need our listeners to help me not starve. So if you can think of any food that I could eat that rhymes with Eric, Jason, or Ferris, email us at...
podcast@biblesavvy.com.
Nikki, what are you eating?
Well, if I go with Nikki, it would be sticky rice, or really anything sticky, chili. But if I went if I went with Nicole, I've got a lot more options. So like any kind of like dole fruits, so like the canned fruits, okay? Anything with like roll in it, so like cinnamon roll, sushi roll, egg roll.
That opens it up.
Oh.
Anything with a bowl, like when you go to Chipotle, you get fajita bowls.
You are set.
Poke bowl.
Oh, man. You're good.
So I'll give you some
food,
Eric.
You're like a queen.
Yeah,
I'll give you this one.
All right, Eric, you got some announcements for everyone.
I have, one announcement in multiple parts because it's Holy Week.
Correct.
So we have three big things going on. The first is Stations of the Cross. If you don't know what Stations of the Cross is, go to the church website, check it out. Think art installation meets prayer experience. And if you've been around Christ Community for a while, you may have already figured this out. About every year, every other year, we commission a new artist to create the artwork for Stations of the Cross. So we have new artwork this year from a new artist at the St. Charles South Elgin campus. So go to the website, check it out. You want to reserve a time slot. It takes about 45 minutes to go through the whole Stations of the Cross experience. There are reserve time slots so that you will have a good experience so it doesn't get overcrowded. At the DeKalb campus, of our five campuses, two campuses host Stations of the Cross. St. Charles South Elgin campus, you need to reserve your time slot. The DeKalb campus also runs Stations of the Cross. You do not need to reserve a time slot for that. And a big reminder is that for the Good Friday services, which, by the way, is the second part of the announcement, we have Stations of the Cross and then Good Friday services. If you're coming to the St. Charles South Elgin campus, know that you cannot reserve a time slot for Stations before or after the Good Friday services because there are hundreds and hundreds of people here that just want to go to a Good Friday service and then walk through the Stations, just kind of look at the art. And so we treat the Stations of the Cross kind of like an art gallery during the Good Friday services. So you need to reserve your slot for the days leading up to Good Friday or early on Good Friday. And then, of course, Easter, Resurrection, Celebration services. There's a bunch of times to choose from all of our campuses. So Stations of the Cross, Good Friday and Easter Sunday.
So much good stuff. All right, Clayton, what passage are we looking at today?
All right, we're going to be in Ezekiel chapter 43, and I want to give you some context here. This is actually the last passage we're doing in Ezekiel here on the podcast. We're getting towards the end of the book.
Bacon! I can eat bacon too.
Jason and bacon. That's right.
Clayton gets bacon and Jason gets bacon.
Oh, wow.
There you go.
I get
He's not going to die. He's not going to die, but Nikki definitely won that
one. Okay, back to context. Okay. Sorry.
And that was not your comma tip of the week right there.
No, it wasn't.
So a little bit more context is needed for this section of Ezekiel because it's really difficult. Like, to be honest, of all of the things in Ezekiel, this is probably the most challenging one to really dig in and figure out what it means for your life. So let me explain what's going on. In chapter 40 to 48, there is this long description of a vision that Ezekiel has of this brand new temple.
Lettuce. Ferris. Lettuce.
You're almost at a BLT, man. If you can figure out how to get tomato to rhyme with like Eric or something.
Hey, this is going to be a really long episode as foods keep popping into my mind.
Oh my gosh.
See if Clayton can keep his train of thought if I keep interrupting.
There was a really long example of the temple.
Yes. Oh, the temple.
Description of the temple.
So for nine chapters here, we've got this long description of the temple, and it's a lot of detail. And you say, why would this book, that is all about these big epic things of, you know, armies coming in and God judging his people and restoring his people and all of these things, why would it end with all of this kind of detailed look at a temple? And some of what it takes to understand that is to know the role of the temple in Israel's life. This was the thing that symbolized their distinction. They were the nation where God said, I'm going to live with you. Like, I'm actually going to move into the neighborhood. I'm going to build a house. I'm going to come in. I'm going to be present right with you right down the street. And that made everything different about the people of Israel. So when God said, I'm actually going to let the temple be destroyed, it was a blow to the most central and important thing about who they were as a people. It said, Wait a minute. We're just like everybody else if God isn't with us. In fact, you might remember from earlier on in the book, you've got this vision of God's glory, right, in the beginning chapters, where God is showing up outside of the temple. He's, you know, he's on his throne. He's showing up with his cherubim. He's all over. And as you read the beginning of the book, you see this vision of that glory of God coming up out of the temple and leaving and going away. And that is a devastating, devastating judgment. So when you get to the end of the book and Ezekiel's saying, well, let me tell you what the restoration is going to be like, he gets this vision of this brand new temple. And the temple is over the top compared to the temple they actually had. If you actually look at the measurements, because it gets really detailed or whatever, it's like 4, 5, 6 times larger than any temple Israel ever had. So it's like, it's way bigger than the tabernacle, which was just a little tent. It's way bigger than Solomon's temple, which was, you know, somewhat bigger, but still not that big. It's actually bigger than the temple that was around in Jesus's day after they rebuilt it. And it's just this massive thing and very elaborate. And so you're looking at this and saying, what am I supposed to get out of this? The big picture is clear. The small stuff is hard. When people look at this temple, there's all sorts of different ideas of like, when is this temple going to show up? We talked a little bit about this in the interview with Dr. Graves at the beginning of this stretch of Ezekiel. Really, there's kind of three views. You can actually find them in the notes in your study Bible. There's a little article, kind of a pullout article in the kind of the early chapters here. And basically, they're these. Some people say, this is just a really over-the-top description of the second temple, the one that got rebuilt before Jesus's day. Okay, so when the people come back to the land, they build this little temple, but this doesn't sound like that at all. Like, that little temple was so dinky that the people who had seen the original temple are like crying that like, this is all we got. So it doesn't seem like this would be the one. And also, no one in those days was like, you know what we should do? We should take Ezekiel's vision and try to build that. Like, there's no one in that time period who is looking at that as like a plan. So it doesn't seem to be referring to that. Some people think maybe this is something that happens at the end of time, you know, when Jesus comes back, there's a new temple or something like that, and people will kind of look at that as kind of prophetic, although it's a little bit weird because this talks about like sacrifices being offered and things like that that don't make sense after Jesus. And then other people say this is a big symbolic image of what God is going to do through his church and through the new creation and so on. But those people say, but it also, I'm not sure why we have so many details if it's a symbol of, you know, this, you know, bigger reality. It seems a little odd that we'd have 8 chapters with measurements in it. So nobody seems to have a clear, like, this is exactly what it is. But when we read it, there are themes that come out to say, what does it mean for God to live with us? What would it look like for God's presence to be with us? That no matter what kind of, whether it's literal, then, now, future, whatever, we can still look at it and say, the meaning of what it means for God to be with his people comes through in some of the details. So it's tricky, it's challenging, but we're gonna work on it and figure it out. So we're gonna read a portion of this. This is like a section in the middle. It's just 12 verses in Ezekiel 43, 1 through 12.
Then the man brought me to the gate facing east, and I saw the glory of the Lord of Israel coming from the east. His voice was like the roar of rushing waters, and the land was radiant with his glory. The vision I saw was like the vision I had seen when he came to destroy the city, and like the visions I had seen by the Kabar River, and I fell face down. The glory of the Lord entered the temple through the gate facing east. Then the Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. While the man was standing beside me, I heard someone speaking to me from inside the temple. He said, "Son of man, this is the place of my throne and the place for the soles of my feet. This is where I will live among the Israelites forever. The people of Israel will never again defile my holy name, neither they nor their kings, by their prostitution and the funeral offerings for their kings at their death. When they placed their threshold next to my threshold and their doorposts beside my doorposts, with only a wall between me and them, they defiled my holy name by their detestable practices. So I destroyed them in my anger. Now let them put away from me their prostitution and the funeral offerings for their kings, and I will live among them forever. Son of man, describe the temple to the people of Israel, that they may be ashamed of their sins. Let them consider its perfection. And if they are ashamed of all they have done, make known to them the design of the temple, its arrangements, its exits and entrances, its whole design, and all its regulations and laws. Write these down before them so that they may be faithful to its design and follow all its regulations. This is the law of the temple. All the surrounding area on top of the mountain will be most holy. Such is the law of the temple."
All right, let's start with observations. What do you guys see in this passage?
The first thing I picked up is vivid imagery, but also sound, is like his voice was like the roar of rushing water. What drew me to that was like, I just came back from a trip, quick trip to Florida, and then I was in California earlier, and I remember being by the beach in California and hearing the rushing, like the roar of the ocean. It was beautiful and terrifying all at the same time. Because you're looking at these waves come in, and I thought to myself, like, God's creation, this creation is beautiful, but it can bring so much, like, it's so much power, and like, it, water like that can be devastating. So to me, it's like this, it gave me that, it brought back like those chills that I felt when I was on the beach in California. It's crazy.
First thing that sticks out to me is the glory of the Lord filling the temple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a connection there with past stories in the Old Testament where when they build the tabernacle for the first time, when they're done, the glory of the Lord comes in. When they build the Solomon builds the temple, glory comes in. Same thing is happening here. And I would think, especially when you compare it to the beginning of Ezekiel and the devastation of the glory leaving the temple, like this is a pretty profound thing for him to say, "I'm moving back in."
Yeah, the observation too is, "And I fell face down."
Yeah.
Like all of that, you know, the roar of the rushing water, that his voice, the radiance of his glory, that vision caused him to fall face down. Like it's such an overwhelming experience.
I've got the observation here of the repeated word defile. Here it comes up a few times. It's kind of the contrast of the repeated word of holy. Both of those things, kind of they're flip sides of each other. So God is holy, which means nothing unclean can be in his presence. You can't bring sin, you can't bring unclean things into his presence. And yet what the people had done before is they had defiled his presence. And there is this sense of, if God's going to be present with you, there's a certain code of conduct, certain kind of behavior, certain decorum that's required to take seriously the fact that a holy God is in your presence.
One of my observations is the kinds of curiosities that emerge when you read, especially like in a book like Ezekiel, and it's sharing details. So verse 4, "The glory of the Lord entered the temple through the gate facing east." Well, why did it enter through the gate facing east? Or when it talks about their prostitution and the funeral offerings. Then my brain goes, well, what are these funeral offerings? What were they doing? And why is the Lord so against these funeral offerings? And so probably a good tip here. This is not the comma tip of the week, but a good tip here is in a good study Bible, like the NIV study Bible, right? There's the footnotes, the study notes at the bottom of the page that will help describe some of these things. And just remember this, the people that made our study Bibles put those tools in the study Bible to be helpful to us. So they're picking and choosing where they think we might be confused or what details need some explanation. And so I always like to remind people, if you're curious about something like, why did the glory enter through the east gate? Of course, they can't put everything in the footnotes or the study notes, whatever you refer to them as, in a study Bible. But if it's really important, it's going to be there. And so if you get really curious about a detail and you don't find an explanation in the study notes or the footnotes, just know it might be something worth continuing to look for, but it's not preeminently important.
Another thing that I picked up on, again, it's just this imagery. He said, Son of man, this is the place of my throne and the place for the soles of my feet. This is where I will live among the Israelites forever. So when you think about the glory of the Lord, a lot of time it's pictured as like this cloud or, you know, this
haze.
Haze, yeah.
Like in a mega church.
Exactly.
The haze where is, the haze is the praises.
Exactly.
It's the fake glory.
But I love that he's like making it like tangible for people. Like, this is where I'm going to sit. These are where the soles of my feet are going to be. Like, I am going to be with you. So again, that's just another, just a vivid thing when I circled the soles of my feet, like, I wonder how big God's soles of his feet are. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
well, and there's the importance of it's a throne, you know, it's not just his living room. Like, he's not just sitting in a comfy chair. Like, the meaning of that chair is that he's the ruler. And I think sometimes we say, I really want to experience God's presence. And for him to be present actually means for him to be in charge. Like, to say, I'm not going to come to a place if you're not going to bow to me as king. Like, this is what this means. If you want me here, it's because I'm going to sit on a throne. And so there's something about that that's both really good, reassuring, of saying, guess what? We've got a good ruler, and the God who's supposed to be in charge is here. But also, it makes you answerable to say, will I submit to him?
Verse 8, when they placed their threshold next to my threshold and their doorposts beside my doorposts, with only a wall between me and them, they defiled my holy name by their detestable practices. So I destroyed them in my anger. Hey, Clayton.
Hey, Clayton.
Yeah.
Why does the Lord hate the fact that they built their thresholds next to his threshold and their doorposts next to his doorposts with only a wall between them?
So, oh my gosh, yeah. So think of the metaphor of moving into the neighborhood, right? So you got God who moves into the neighborhood. And that actually clarifies a lot of things. When you're reading weird stuff like Leviticus and Ezekiel that talk about temple sorts of things, if you just say, what would it be like if God lived down the street from me? You start to say, oh, wait, this totally makes sense. If God was my neighbor, it would not be okay for me to just casually leave things out in the yard that were, you know, gross or offensive or whatever. Like, there would automatically be like, oh, I should probably...
No pink flamingos
in your yard or whatever. Obnoxious political signs in your yard, whatever. You know, like, you got these things where you say, I just wouldn't do it that way if I realized who was living next to me. In the kind of description of what God expects in, you know, the Old Testament, in the Torah, you've got things like, there are things that are unclean in God's presence, that are disrespectful in God's presence, that are ordinary things that may be okay for a different place, but if you're going to come in here, there's a certain decorum, I keep using that word, to how you're going to interact with him. But if what you do is you build up on the property line right up next to God's house, and you've got just on the other side of the line the things that God doesn't want going on in your house, and it's right next to his house, it's like, you know, your neighbors that are too close and all of a sudden they're playing music at a party late at night or whatever, and you're like, what's going on? You know what I mean? It's that kind of thing, except we're talking about moral and ceremonial purity next to God. So for him to say, you didn't respect the fact that I came and moved into this place and you treated it like casual, unclean, and you didn't respect the fact that that shouldn't belong in my presence. You got so close to me that all of that stuff came up into my presence. That's what made me angry.
Man, am I glad I played the Hey Clayton sound. That was a good analogy. The haze is where the praise is.
All right, let's move on to one of the M's in comma. Let's talk about message. Based on what you saw here, what is a principle that you can draw from the text?
My message is God wants to be with you, but you have to want to be with God.
That sound means it's time for your comma tip of the week. I watered my lawn one time last summer. I couldn't understand why it still turned brown. I mean, that one time I watered it really good. Psalm 1, blessed is the person whose delight is in the law of the Lord, who meditates on it day and night. That person is like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season and whose leaf does not wither, and whatever they do prospers. Regular watering. That's what daily Bible reading is all about. Not every day will seem like an amazing experience, but those who make God's word a priority flourish. So let's stay at it. Even through a long book like Ezekiel, knowing that the Lord is nourishing, equipping, and refreshing us as we do. And this has been your comma tip of the week.
Eric, I think that story's made up. You take care of your lawn. I don't think you only watered it once last summer.
That is true. It was very, very sarcastic. Yeah. I do not allow my lawn to brown out.
But a
out.
Good tie, you know.
It's a good analogy. Yeah. What's your message, Eric?
All right, my message is God's glory, a.k.a. his presence, requires something of us.
My message is probably pretty similar to both of those. It's the gift of God's presence requires the gift of holiness. So when we think of God coming to live with us, you know, one way to think about the temple is like, it's like the Garden of Eden. And if you're going to be in the Garden of Eden, if you want to be in his presence, like you've got to be holy. You can't just bring in something that's going to mess up paradise. It's a gift to be there, but you also have to have the gift of being holy and pure in order to be in that presence. So the gift of God's presence requires the gift of holiness. All right, let's go on to the other M in comma, which is meditation. This is when we prayerfully ponder for a short period of time. We usually give you about 45 seconds, but you're free to take more time than that if you want. For this one, rather than pick one particular line in the passage, what I want you to do is actually use your imagination. Okay, this is one of those ones where there's visual things going on, especially if you've been following kind of what the vision of God's glory looks like in Ezekiel. And I want you to imagine being there at the temple, when the presence of the holy God, the glorious God, whose voice is like the roar of rushing waters, arrives to move into the temple. How would you feel? How would you react? What would you experience? Spend some time and talk with God about that. All right, let's go on to the A in comma, which is application. How do you respond? What do you do in light of all of this?
Okay, so my message is God wants to be with you, but you have to want to be with God. So my application is to identify the fact that, again, if I want to be with God, I have to get rid of the things in my life that will keep me from being and living fully with him and for him. So it's identifying those things. It's taking some time to do an honest assessment of it and trying to do something about it, you know? God wants to be with you, but you have to want to be with God.
Okay, so my application based on my message, and my message being that God's glory, aka his presence, requires something of us. We're talking about the fact that you can't just go waltzing into God's presence, bringing in all your sin, and expect that that's okay. But what's also true is that the more you experience the presence of God, the less you want to be dancing with that dance partner of sin. Like, you so want to experience more of God's presence because it's so good that you want to get rid of that sin. And so you don't want to bring your sin into God's presence, but also true, you can. And then your sin's going to be exposed and you're going to want to get rid of it because the goodness of God's presence is better than whatever dalliance you have with sin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so my application probably is going to sound similar, like we're building on a theme here. It's pretty obvious that this text is talking about something. So my message was the gift of God's presence requires the gift of holiness. And that's what Eric is talking about. And I actually think that this week of all weeks, Holy Week, is a really good time to reflect on this. Because first of all, there's like an intensity to saying, where am I actually at, you know, with God? And so you see some of those places where you say, this is not okay in God's presence. I'm reflecting on that and bringing that in confession to God. But there's also something really cool about seeing what Jesus did in response to our sin. Because what it does is it makes possible what Eric's talking about. If Jesus gave us the status of being holy, like he paid for the penalty for our sin, which means it's not hanging over our head, and our status is not condemned anymore, it's forgiven, it's holy, it's righteous, that means we have permission to come into God's presence. At the same time, our lives are catching up with that reality, right? Like our behavior and our attitudes still have sin to be purged, which means because of Jesus dying on the cross, we get to come into God's presence like Eric's talking about and experience what his presence is like so that it starts to purge us and give us power over sin. And there's something about that gift of holiness, the status of being holy in Jesus and the process of becoming actually holy through being in his presence. That's really, really incredible. It's what gives us hope and that's what makes this week so good.
That's good stuff. All right, friends, there you have it. Thanks for listening this week. Join us again next Monday for a new episode. We'll be looking at another passage from the Bible Savvy reading schedule. In the meantime, if you are not following along with us, check out BibleSavvy.com to download it and to start reading today. Also, you can subscribe and leave a review on whatever platform you're listening on. Email us your questions or suggestions at podcast@BibleSavvy.com. Lastly, tell your friends, and we'll talk to you next week.